What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. This is another free bonus, which is the audio from a great panel that I co-hosted with Walker Bragman for Paste Magazine, for Paste Politics, which we recorded at Paste Studio. To find video of that, you can just go to pastemagazine.com/studio. Again, that's pastemagazine.com/studio. Hi everyone, I'm Katie Halper, and we are reporting live from the Paste Studio for Paste Politics.
And I'm Walker Bragman, and we're really excited because we have a pretty kick-ass panel here today.
If we do say so ourselves. And we will go from left to right. We have Aaron Mate, who is a reporter for The Real News and a journalist who writes for The Nation. Welcome.
Thank you.
We have Malaika Jabali, who is an activist, an attorney, and a writer for places including Current Affairs. We have Nomiki Konst, who's a Renaissance woman, but for now we'll just say she's a... I've never seen someone offended by that. She's a medieval woman. No, and she's running for public advocate. So welcome, everyone. And Walker, everyone knows. Whatevs. Walker from Paste. Walker, journalist, also. Anything else you want to say?
That works.
We're a very formal show, as you can tell.
Prolific tweeters. You guys are leaving out the...
Oh, and one of the only people to write about Yemen. So thank you for doing that, because that's something that I think no one else pays attention to.
Talk about it.
Yeah, talk about it. So right now, we're going to talk about the midterms.
First impressions?
Hot takes?
I have a hot take.
Okay, cool.
So, great. You know, last night there was a lot of depression. I think a lot of folks watching cable news, the national news, were really upset by what happened in Florida and Texas and who knows what's going to happen in Georgia. Randy Bryce, who we had a lot of hopes for, didn't win, and it was by a larger margin than some predicted. But with that being said, you know, we won Congress, and
right. We
got 100 women elected to Congress.
Right.
And the New York State Senate, you know, to be a little bit focused here, has been a real fight. And the New York State Senate is blue, which means Andrew Cuomo, who wants to be president, can't hide behind the Senate anymore. And that can make a huge difference on national politics if New York is able to pass things like, Medicare for all, campaign finance reform. They can, you know, immigration reform. There's a whole slew of issues that have been blocked by the New York State Senate that we could lead on, more so than California, because California, even though they have a supermajority, isn't passing a lot of the stuff because of the corporate interests. But I think now the Senate makeup is going to be pretty strong.
So you're saying not only will there be differences in New York State, but that this will have a national effect?
Yes.
And how does that happen? It just kind of sets a precedent?
Well, yeah. I mean, New York is a fairly important state. We have Wall Street here. You know, big real estate is more or less centered here. Donald Trump is from here. We have a couple of, you know, potential presidential candidates who are based here, from Michael Bloomberg to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to Governor Cuomo, who is sitting on a coffer of $30+ million that he could potentially use in a presidential primary. That's huge. So, you know, just the idea of New York is a big deal. The media industry is based here. But if New York is able to pass these reforms, it puts more pressure on California to do so and other progressive states. I mean, don't forget, we passed marriage equality in Iowa first. Mm. That's embarrassing.
Wow. Yeah.
And New York is like, well, we passed marriage equality like 8 years ago, but well after Iowa. Right. So if New York can lead on these things, I think it creates a safe space for other states to do the same thing.
Great. Aaron, were you surprised by any results? Were you disappointed by any results? Anything stand out as either good or bad, since you're kind of a prolific mediaite?
Well, I'm also kind of a political downer. So, right. And I feel down, I do. Like
But then you shouldn't feel down because you should have already expected it.
That's true. Well, you know, I didn't expect Vangelis. I didn't expect Vangelis to lose so badly, at least.
Oh, yeah. So, by the way, just so everyone's on the same page out here. So we're talking, you mentioned Randy Bryce of Wisconsin. Of course, Gillum in Florida, Beto in Texas. Stacey Abrams is contesting, which we'll talk about in a second. Vangelis in Maryland. And then we'll get to the victories. But those were to varying degrees, surprising or not surprising, losses.
Thompson as well in Kansas.
Yeah, and he did my show, so
I'll start with the positive.
Okay.
The reenfranchisement of people being convicted in Florida is amazing, and that's exciting, and I'm encouraged about what that means for future elections. But, you know, the fact that the best that Democrats could do was just take the House, and as it stands right now, by not that much, I think they could have... I don't think their margin of, their lead in the House is that big, or at least as big as it could have been or was predicted. After 2 years of Donald Trump, is this to me depressing? The fact that, the Senate wasn't even competitive, and there were so many things to run on. There was, the tax heist, the biggest upward of transfer of wealth in U.S. history, the further gutting of our pretty meager healthcare system, the pulling out of the Iran deal and tearing up the Paris Accords. These were awful things that I think could have mobilized a lot of voters. And crucially, and this is my main takeaway, is that last night is a reminder to me that politics as usual in terms of trying to win over a small number of swing votes and mostly white voters is just not going to cut it. And what about all those people who stay on the sidelines? I mean, there was record turnout last night, but still, relative to other industrialized countries, it's still pretty weak. And so for democracy, we've set the bar really low. And as a result, I think that's reflected in the results last night.
Malaika, you are a Georgian,
yes.
Correct?
Yep.
As in the
raised
state,
in Georgia,
not the country.
Not the country, if you can't tell.
Contrary, I know. Popular belief. Maybe we can just talk about the results from last night in Georgia, if you were surprised, and why you think what happened.
So I was raised in Georgia, so the fact that she even got that close is a surprise to us. The fact that Andrew Gillum got that close is a surprise to us. I think just kind of taking a step back and thinking about your earlier question in terms of first takes, it's a protracted struggle. So I'm just going to put on my activist hat. Yeah. We look at electoral politics as one tool. It's not a panacea. We're going to see these types of swings regardless, as long as we have a two-party system, as long as we live under capitalism. We're going to see these swings where people have economic anxieties and they might go one way or the other. And every election might feel like a disappointment if we're not, you know, if Democrats aren't winning. At the same time, the two-party system right now is very limited. So there are a lot of people who felt disenfranchised for a really long time, who don't feel that their voice is represented in politics. But if the Democratic Party can engage people and excite people, which is what they did in Florida, which is what they did in Georgia, then they can bring a huge amount of people out. So obviously we all know that Florida and Georgia, actually I'm not too sure about Florida right now, but Georgia is dealing with an immense amount of voter suppression. So Brian Kemp, he purged about 1.4 million voters who are registered but just are inactive. If we're looking at that, if we're looking at the polling sites that he closed earlier, that the ACLU had to file a lawsuit to open those back up, and these are in rural districts where there are Black people who live in these rural areas. And they also suppress the vote in many urban communities. So I actually saw this. This has been going on for years. I was raised in a county called DeKalb. It's one of the most diverse counties in the country. It went overwhelmingly for Stacey Abrams. And they initiated voter suppression tactics against Cynthia McKinney, a very radical candidate from 2000, 2004, and they ousted her. And we've been seeing that since then. So this is an ongoing issue. But the fact that she even got all that despite, you know, the voter suppression is huge. And we should take that as a win.
Right. But you would say that the maybe kind of piggybacking on what you were saying about how the win was less than perhaps expected or hoped for, that maybe there was a lack of excitement
I think it varies. So again, if Democrats can find a candidate to be excited for, then they can win. Right. And these are going to be issues that translate across race and class that are going to be intersectional. In 2016, we didn't see that so much with the Democratic candidate. However, Stacey Abrams was reaching across race. She was talking about, you know, a multiracial coalition of voters to support, you know, a living wage, to support
Medicaid expansion.
The expansion of Medicaid, collective bargaining, which is unheard of in Georgia. We're a right-to-work state, which obviously, you know, Republicans with their shenanigans, right-to-work means that you have a right to get fired very easily.
It's anti-union, but they like to make it sound like it's about freedom.
Exactly, and she's pro-union, which you would not expect somebody to get that many votes in Georgia with that type of platform.
Can I just amend my downerness? Yeah. Like, I don't apply that across the board to every single state, and especially, you know, learning about Georgia over the last little while, like, that to me is a vote that's just straight up stolen, you know, looking at what's happening. I mean, it's obvious. Like, that's just straight up voter suppression. And Stacey Abrams did everything that could possibly
be still doing. She's not. So this is actually, I wanted to ask you, you kind of spoke to this a second ago, Malaika, but the piece that you wrote in Current Affairs called The Color of Economic Anxiety, which you wrote before the midterm, you said, instead of addressing the conservative economic policies that defined the Democratic Party for decades and helped undermine black progress, Clinton attempted to appeal to black voters' identity. So my question is, and you kind of spoke to this, if you think that the Dems did change their appeal this time around, especially in the Midwest and in the South, and do you think it changed how black voters turned out and the results?
I think it depends. So I know in Wisconsin, I actually went back there earlier last month.
Because that's where you did the reporting for that piece.
Sorry, right. I just wanted to do like an update. 1 year later, where are people thinking going into the midterm elections, the general elections? And I spoke with an activist there, a political organizer named Angela Ling. Mm-hmm. She's the president of an organization called BLOC, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities. And I think the key there was about the ground game. Mm. It was talking about economic issues, but actually going to these communities. I think the main problem with Hillary Clinton in 2016, I mean, there are a bevy of things. Obviously, I think economic anxieties is a major issue. But how you reach people despite that is important. And she never even stepped foot in Wisconsin. So if you're dealing with, you know, the highest rate of black male joblessness in the country, which is what black males are experiencing in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee specifically, if you're dealing with the highest rate of black male incarceration in the country, at least go to the state. At least go, you know, to Milwaukee where this is happening at ground zero. And she did not do that, and everybody remembered that. So I think this time the Democratic forerunner, Tony Evers, he actually went around to these communities. BLOC endorsed him. I think having that kind of cosign let people know, okay, at least he is thinking about us. As to how much, you know, people can get over their disillusionment if they're dealing with economic anxieties, it remains to be seen. Some people might be excited even if they're poor and dealing with, you know, evictions or whatever, they might still be engaged if somebody at least is looking at them and going to their doors and talking to them.
Right. Now, do we think that the national Democratic brand, what role do we think that played in this election?
So this is actually what I was just going to say. Last year I was in Wisconsin as well, and it was very clear that they were hustling very hard to rebuild the infrastructure of Democrats, not necessarily the party, but Democrats. Like, what does a Democrat mean? They weren't waiting for the DNC to step in or even the state Democratic Party to be fully funded. People were just kind of organically doing it on their own and defining the message on their own. When I look at this election right now, and, you know, we talked about this a little bit beforehand, you see races like Beto O'Rourke and Gillum and Stacey Abrams. They deserve that attention, and they should be getting that attention. But what I worry about is when all of the attention and money is focused on candidates, just like presidential candidates were our addiction for the Democratic Party, what happens in between? Where's the movement building? And I believe that the Democratic Party institutionally should be decentralized so that movement building is happening in between, so that the voter suppression you know, the voter suppression didn't happen yesterday. The voter suppression's been going on for decades. It's decades in the making. When we close our eyes and we're focused on other things, right, that frankly I think are a result of the centralized Democratic Party.
So actually, I want to ask about that. What could the Democrats do? This is a big question about voter suppression. How much does their working on other things take away from what they could be doing to lower voter suppression or to fight it?
Well, I think what, you know, the DNC traditionally has had a pretty good legal hotline for like the night of the election in preparation. They send lawyers out to multiple states. They do that for presidential years. They do it for key races. I do think they take that very seriously, but it's not enough. I mean,
the night of, though, right?
The night of, and sometimes in preparation
to challenge gerrymandering more.
And I think they're doing some of that. But again, if you're not operating in states, and I love the fact that we won 100 women. Well, they're not all Democrats, but 100 women ran and won, and we won Congress back. I think that is some of the movement work that needs to happen in between. But when you don't fund your parties, when everybody's so obsessed with candidates, and then you have consultants who are building these outside organizations, and, you know, this is a weird plug I'm going to give to Tom Perez here. Tom Perez gets a lot of crap. DNC chair. He gets a lot of crap. He should, frankly, because I think the DNC has a lot of work to do, and I don't think it's taken it as seriously as it should. I'm no longer on this Democratic commission, so I can say whatever I want. I
mean, do they have a message? Do they have
The message isn't so much it. You know, what happens is you have these outside forces who are like, the DNC is not doing their job. They're not doing their job. Here, come donate to our C4 over here. And so all the money goes to the C4s, which have their own agendas, and it's supporting their own candidates. And so that money, it's like, it's a chicken or egg thing. Like, you need to put the money into the DNC so that it goes to state parties, but then, like, the DNC is sucking, so nobody wants to give money to the DNC. So the state parties need the money so they can build the infrastructure to win the legislatures back and fight gerrymandering. But if they have no money, they can't do that.
Right.
Well, I guess I should clarify. When I say they have no message, I mean the party has – I mean it's done some changes. It's implemented some changes. A lot of them are sort of aesthetic. Sure. But – you know, they elected Pelosi and Schumer and Perez to lead it into the future, and that leadership has really looked kind of like what it was before: interference in primaries, the same lack of prioritization of the state races, the same fundraising emails that are policy free, and the same refusal to coalesce around a populist platform. So, I mean, does that has to have
platform.
Progressive populist platform, but that has to have some effect, right, on the races.
I mean, it's funny because I feel like that's always my perspective, but I actually think that, like, the fact that Stacey Abrams and Gillum came so close, I think, like, they did. I mean, I'm very impressed and happy and encouraged by the fact that Stacey Abrams is contesting this, because we never see that. So let's say she loses, just to see a Democrat. Imagine if Gore had done that, right? Gore, it was like a no-brainer. I think that it's kind of related to what you were saying about the messaging and the position of the Democrat. It's kind of unapologetically.
Well, it's like the candidates are succeeding despite that.
Exactly,
not because of the party's leadership.
Right.
I think that goes back to the point that no one's looking for the DNC to save them. No one's looking for the Democrats to save them. You know, say Stacey Abrams is being a strong woman, as she should be, and she's saying, you know, we're contesting this. You know, the buck stops at her.
Yeah.
And she knows what went down. And you hear parties pressure these candidates to get out of a race, I don't know why. Like, everybody's got a different agenda.
Dinner parties or because consulting? I don't understand where that comes from.
I think it depends on the race. Yeah. You know, they probably have a little bit more room with Georgia than other races, but...
And Aaron, as someone who's covered Russiagate a lot, and we saw that ultimately the Dems, despite their, 2 years minus like 2 months of nonstop coverage and the media's nonstop coverage of Russiagate, they kind of stopped talking about it. So I want to know what damage, if any, hint, hint, you thought has been happened as a result of the focus on Russiagate.
I think this hyper-focus on this conspiracy theory that Trump and the Kremlin engaged in a high-level collusion scheme to release emails on a certain schedule in order to win the presidency, I guess that's the theory. Or maybe the Russians stole some voter information and gave that to Trump for him to consult. I think the hyper-focus on that, it got a lot of Democratic stalwarts some primetime cable news slots. They got to appear on cable news and talk about this and speak about how they're bravely standing up to the compromised president. It helped them, and it got ratings for all the outlets that promoted it. But I think that it totally sidelined everybody else, because what are we supposed to do? I mean, we're supposed to all revere Mueller and protect him at all costs and think that he's going to solve all our problems and get rid of this nightmare in the Oval Office. So, which then leaves everybody on the sidelines, and there's nothing to get involved in. So, like, you know, there was mobilization around, like, a couple of things, like the Muslim ban and misogyny and anti-immigrant cruelty. But aside from that, there was not that much mobilization. Like the tax heist, there wasn't like huge major rallies and actions. And so I think that Russiagate kind of like both raised expectations that Trump was going to get impeached because he's a Kremlin dupe, and also left people on the sidelines because there's not much to get involved in. And you know, this is to me a part of a, going back to the Democratic brand question. I think part of the reason Russiagate exists and the space in which it's created is because Democrats don't have a real commitment to anything substantial that can win over people. So they need constant things to jump on to do performative wokeness and performative resistance. And Russiagate was that opportunity. If you look at who's been successful for Democrats in the last 30 years, it's basically a couple of people. We had 2006, there was so much backlash against Bush that Democrats did well. But in terms of national candidates, we had Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. They did well. But if you look at them, they share, I think, a particular characteristic, which is that they're able to come across as being principled and lofty and caring, while really still following the same centrist, democratic, corporate, neoliberal playbook. Everybody else, like Michael Dukakis, Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, they're not very appealing people. So basically, like, Democrats' national brand relies on essentially fooling people into thinking that, like, their leaders are, like, noble and
awesome. Or in touch, right?
Yeah, or in touch. I feel your pain. Yeah. Exactly.
The failure of Republicans.
Yeah. And I just don't think it's enough. And, like, to run it on the fact that the Republicans are cruel and they want to take away even more of your health care, I mean, that can maybe win the House in this election. But to win over new voters and to, like, actually have a real wave, it's not going to cut it.
Well, can I just make one point about Russia? Because this is something I think it's a business model. The media and the Democratic Party make money off of controversy. And before the election cycle starts, right, what filled in that space?
Right. Yeah.
You can talk about all these House races in like December of last year, mm-hmm. but you could talk about Russia all day long and get those Russia emails. And just in time for the horse race to start, oh, look it, we forgot about Russia. And it makes money for both of these two industries. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, Malaika, you, in your article referencing the color of economic anxiety.
You had
a great line about Milwaukee that in this one neighborhood the jobs left but the police presence remained, mm-hmm. and it just that line summed up for me kind of the feeling of what you were trying to get across. It's just this hopelessness that is so pervasive around America today. And when we talk about what the Democrats have done to bring out the vote and inspire people, I mean, do you see that inspiration when you go around? Do you see that people are inspired, or do you feel like there's a lot of room for improvement?
I think there is a lot of room for improvement, with the caveat that I think it should come from the ground. So I think grassroots organizations, I think activists, I think organizers should decide what their political process, what the next steps are going to be for them. So if the Democratic Party is not it, which is what Khalif Rainey, who's an alderman in Milwaukee, if he thinks that there is an independent political party that can come from this eventually, then that might be the avenue. Because right now, we're looking at democratic reforms, we're looking at reforms to capitalism, even if you think about the people who are considered the most left in the Democratic Party who've been successful, AOC and Bernie Sanders, they're not talking about radically transforming capitalism. And I think as long as you have...
Which is why they're alive, probably.
Also that. I mean, how they got in office. But as long as we have that, we're also going to have...
No self.
We're going to have a prison industrial complex that, you know, over-incarcerates black men. You're going to have joblessness. You're going to have manufacturing companies that have a race to the bottom, and they're moving their operations to China and Mexico, which is exactly what happened in Milwaukee. And a lot, what a lot of, so to answer your question, it depends on where you go. I think the, you know, black voters are not a monolith. In the South, you're going to see a little bit more economic opportunity. There's a reverse great migration happening right now where more people are moving back to, like, my home state of Georgia. We're actually the number one recipient of New York migrants. So black people moving from New York are going to Georgia. So there's been an uptick in people moving from California and all the places that they went to during the Great Migration back to the South. So you're going to keep bouncing around because America, honestly, is just not the place to be if you're looking for any sort of reprieve from capitalism. It's not going to happen.
But it just seems to me that these issues exist and they don't get talked about. And both parties are sort of content with not talking about them. And that creates this void that gets filled by whoever decides to fill it. And more often than not, it's some angry guy willing to point a finger at the most vulnerable communities.
You got a guy pointing his finger at inequality, which is much better. Finger wagging.
Is that a Bernard?
That's a Bernard. That's the same Bernard thing. Which is what I always think. I mean, I say this all the time. I sound like a broken record. But, like, you don't fight a right-wing populist with a moderate. You fight a right-wing populist with an exciting, progressive populist who, like we were saying about feeling people's pain, right? We all know Trump was fake. He doesn't care about people, and he doesn't feel their pain. But he kind of sold it, right? Bernie Sanders does care about people's pain, and he does have the policies that help people. Clinton, and forget, I'm not just focusing, I mean, moving forward, right? Like, politicians who don't make it clear that they feel people's pain, I think, and who don't actually offer policies, those are the people who lose. And the people who try to get everyone and try to be moderate, I don't get why people don't understand that being a moderate, it's not just bad policy, but it's bad politics. You just don't run against Donald Trump by being moderate.
I think, yes, and especially not in this climate. So Bill Clinton won, but I think what a lot, you know, when he ran in, I guess it was 92 and 96. And what a lot of people don't realize is that he had to really sell himself to the black community because they were pretty
Arsenio.
So right. It was he didn't win them over. So in midterm elections, like, he was struggling, and it really took a lot because people were still struggling with these same economic issues then. So it took a identity politics. So it might work in the short run. You know, just weaponizing identity politics, I should say.
And at the same time, dog whistling to racists.
Absolutely. Yeah. And taking, you know,
talented.
Very taking Walmart versatile. Money, being a corporatist, and also saying, you know, welfare queens and well, he didn't say that, but he was still talking about welfare reform.
Right, he did it.
Right.
So Newt Gingrich said welfare queens, and the Dems just enacted the policy that he wanted.
Signed it, exactly.
Right.
But he did do that stuff with Jesse Jackson and Sister Souljah, right? Yeah. Like, a lot of dog whistling. But yes.
Yeah. I don't even remember what the rest of my point was, but that's basically
No, it was great.
I have a question for Malika. So in your piece, you point out that there was a huge drop in black voters in Wisconsin from Obama to Clinton.
Yeah.
But how much of that can we say is economic anxiety versus voter suppression? Because there was that in Wisconsin. There was that study that there was like 23,000 black voters who were kicked off the rolls. In Wisconsin?
Yes. So a couple of points with that. One of them is a caveat that my article is not, you know, arguing for a causation. I'm not making any attempt to be a data scientist. This is not a dissertation. I don't think that economic anxiety, I'm not arguing at least that economic anxiety is a cause for why Hillary Clinton won. I'm saying that there is a correlation. So if we see that this is the state where Bernie Sanders performed the best amongst black people, if he had a very strong economic platform, if Hillary Clinton didn't even go to the state and she's a corporatist, if there's a history of collective bargaining in this state amongst the black people of being, you know, very familiar with a lot of these progressive policies of socialist mayors, of democratic socialism amongst the black community. Mm. If we're seeing all these multiple factors, why isn't the Democratic Party asking why instead of just pinning it to voter suppression? Point blank period, and assuming that it's white Wisconsinites who shifted the election when it was really black people in Wisconsin who failed to show up, along
with
other
who didn't show up. Voter shame.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't. Yes, I definitely.
I
definitely want to vilify.
Just
a
turn of phrase. I know.
Yes, because the whole point of the article is to humanize people who have been vilified.
Right.
So it was them along with progressive whites who stayed home. So there is, I will always talk about voter suppression. I think that it's always going to be a factor as long as the black people live in this country where there's white supremacy and they think that there's some threat of another. But when you look at the studies in Milwaukee, that study is looking at something from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they're estimating that based on the number of black people who are in certain counties and where voter turnout lowered, where it declined. But it's not asking why they actually stayed home. It's just assuming that because that it was a higher black county, then it must be the reason why they stayed home, right, because of voter suppression.
Can I just ask a follow-up question? Because I do think that there's this narrative that is very unhealthy, like you're saying, about voter shaming.
Yeah.
It's no one's fault. Obviously, it's about who the messenger is and whether they're speaking to that audience. There's also this message that's out right now that white woman, you know, come get your... What is it? What's that article that was out the other day? White woman, come get your...
By a white
people
woman,
or something,
right?
Like, yeah, oh, no. it was blaming white women, and I'm a white woman, so you know, whatever. I'll take responsibility for my people. Yeah. But
the Greeks.
But is that something that is true, or is it, you know, they blame white women for voting for Trump and bringing Trump, you know, into office, but is it causation? Let's go, you know.
It's a half truth. So of course white people voted for Trump, but they also voted for Mitt Romney at about the same margin. They voted for George Bush at about the same margin. Basically, every Republican president since Nixon, 60% of white people voted for them. And Trump received the same margin at 60%. So to me, that's not really telling the full picture. If we're talking about a consistent narrative, white people tend to vote for white interests. So that's not new.
Or perceived white, or what they believe. Or racial stuff, not economic stuff. I mean, that's a whole other thing, right?
Right, but what they perceive to be the white candidate is how 60% of white people vote in every presidential election. So to me, the story wasn't about that because that didn't change in 2016. Obviously, he was more explicit with his racism. Instead of using a dog whistle, he used a bullhorn, and we're still seeing that right now. To me, the story was about the fact that the Democratic base was not energized enough. So in three states decided the election. You could either say Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, that's the Democrats generally, or Wisconsin, Michigan, and Florida. Hillary Clinton had less of a black voter turnout in those three states. If she had got just a little bit more of those votes, as Obama did, she would have won the election. So,
and yes, it was close in Florida, too. It was close.
Yes, it was.
And I think Ben Jealous said on our show that, like, if they had spent a quarter of the money that they spent on media on registering black voters, it would have been a total game changer.
There was this anecdote, it's been written about now, but it was sort of a secret for a while, that some of the people who were on the Bernie campaign went into the transition team, well, not for Hillary, but they were working at the DNC and helping out with the Hillary campaign. And they wanted Bernie to run around and campaign for Hillary in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And the backstory, and I think it was in the Daily Beast, maybe like a couple of weeks after the election, where the title was, can I swear?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Thumbs up. They didn't fucking listen to us. Was the title?
Right. Yeah.
And part of that was a group of Bernie, and I was in that room. I was in the room.
Were you the cursor?
I was the cursor. Yeah. But there was a bunch of us in the room.
Drops the F bombs a lot.
I do.
It's good.
It's actually kind of funny. It's true. Yeah. I didn't swear until I was like 25.
You're making up for lost time.
Yeah. But we sat in a room and we talked about what it would take to win over these states because we knew that people were angry at Hillary and they were staying home. And so we warned them and said, you got to talk about criminal justice reform. You have to talk about fracking. You have to talk about TPP. And when you line up those issues, that's 5 or 6 points. Furthermore, we found out that transition team, they wanted Bernie to run around the country and they wouldn't pay for his flight. You know, he would fly on commercial air.
What?
Who cares now? I can say this stuff.
No, I'm not shocked. Yeah. Saying, I'm
he was flying on commercial air, and it was delaying him because people would stop him. He'd have to go through security. So they said, could you just put him on one of the planes, the DNC planes? And they said, no, 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 we can't afford it. And at the same time, they said, well, then you just spent $60 million last week in Houston, Texas on one set of ads in 1 week, and you can't pay for $100,000 for Bernie Sanders to go win you the election.
Right.
But it's Jill Stein's fault.
Right, yeah. Right. And just a quick note. I want to look at the exact stat, but Donald Trump got about 400,000 more votes than Mitt Romney between 2012 and 2016. That's what went to the Republican candidate, which you could probably attribute to just general population increases. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, lost about 680,000 votes between 2012 and 2016. So 680,000 more voters showed up for President Obama versus Hillary Clinton. And so why are we going around blaming like this huge backlash in, you know, these Midwest states when really the story is the story of non-voters?
That's it.
It's funny. I had Leslie Lee on my show. He's a great guy. He's a great podcast host. He has a show called The Struggle Session. He also started the hashtag Bernie Made Me White, which was making fun of the media's representation of Bernie supporters. But we were just talking about this. I don't remember why it came up, but he said, of course, the world, we have races. Oh, there was a study that said that Trump voters were motivated by racial animus or by racism. And we can talk about the study later because it's pretty bogus the way it
is. Multiple studies.
Right. Yeah, but there was something like very recent, I guess.
He said, we know that.
Like, and the people citing this have been saying that white people are racist. Like, that's how we understand institutionalized racism. Why is that new?
Right.
And he also said that's not an excuse for losing to Trump. If Obama was able to win over these white racists, why wasn't Hillary? And he goes, as a racist herself, Hillary should have had an easier time winning over white racists. Which, you know, I thought we can leave that part. But, I mean, I thought it's true. It's like, yeah, how can people say that?
Well, this is something that I've taken a lot of heat for.
Yeah.
But talking about the connection between economics and racism and the fact that when you have a country where only 28% of Americans are considered financially healthy, where 78% of full-time workers live paycheck to paycheck, and where most people can't afford a $1,000 emergency and have no savings and live in debt, and life expectancy is on the decline, and these statistics, I could go on and on and on. But when that's like your baseline and that's just considered normal and it's not getting talked about and your candidates aren't talking about it, like, yeah, they're going to turn to somebody who offers them somebody to blame. And why? And this is something that has been, it's been documented, like times of perceived scarcity changed the way that we look at people of different races. We see them as more other. This is so well documented, and in Germany and in Russia too.
And it's also the idea that you're claiming that there's a narrative that if you say that you are co-signing racism, which it's actually it's anti-racism which motivates people, I think, to make that point. You are trying to diagnose one of the ways this happens, and it's not sugarcoating racism, and it's not saying it's only economic stuff, but we know that this stuff contributes to it. So why wouldn't we want to look at that and kind of make the case for explicitly? Also, you have to explicitly talk about class and race, or else people definitely won't come over to anyone but Trump.
Especially, too, if the official opposition party has been co-signing that exact same dynamic for years, like as we talked about. Bill Clinton was a dog whistler. I mean, why do you think he gutted welfare in this country? Was it because he genuinely
predators?
I mean, like, does Bill Clinton really think that ending welfare as we know it was going to help the country and help people? No. Like that was a way to cater to white racists, as it was when he attacked Sister Souljah, who at the time was a relatively, like, not very well-known rapper.
Yeah. I wonder if her records went up.
I hope it did. Yeah. I mean, like, because she was brave, and basically he attacked her because she had a lyric about violence against...
Yeah.
So, like, what was...
And
so
to get at Jesse Jackson.
And, exactly. So it's like, it doesn't help that the official opposition party has been co-signing this for years and years, and we have to point out that, like, I mean, it, like... Unless we address the root of it and offer people an alternative, it's like not going to it's going to keep appealing to people, all the more so if the leaders we supposedly identify with have been abetting it as well.
Especially now with the demographic shift. I mean, this country is becoming increasingly people of color, and the white population is shrinking, and people see that. There are people that see that as a threat, and this is something that... a friend of mine was stresses a lot when in this conversation about economic anxiety and racial animus, but that's a factor, and that will only be seen as a threat
it's also a factor for people of color. This is the thing I think that was so important about your article, is like there's this weird false dichotomy that people of color don't care about economics, which is like, where does that come from? And if you understand racism, you get that that's like an extra challenge for people of color, right? Like capitalism is bad for everyone, and especially like the less straight white male you are, the worse off, right? The issue is it's not like only... it's not like every straight white man is rich and every person of color is poor. But Can you just talk a bit about like why you even felt the need? I mean, do you think that that is a view that's presented, this false dichotomy between race and class, and talk?
Yeah, there is absolutely a false dichotomy that I think erases Black people from the narrative of the working class. When you think about blue collar voters, when you think about the Midwest, Black people in the Midwest who have a pretty strong presence there, they have for the last, you know, maybe 50, 60 years since the Great Migration have been in the Midwest. And just to, you know, push back a little bit on your earlier statement about people choosing, I guess, fascism as an option, some people, white people, are. So a lot of Black people, in the face of economic anxiety, many of them stay home. They're disillusioned. Right. So I think when you have this combination, you know, speaking of intersectionality, when you have a combination of white supremacy and capitalism, then fascism is an option because you're used to white supremacy being able to comfort you in that time of need. You know, obviously, in a capitalist system, everybody is going to be, the masses of people are going to be suffering.
Right.
But how we deal with that, I think, as a nation, we need to confront in terms of recognizing that it's mostly white people who are doing this and why. And, you know, I think it's going to take some organizing to determine exactly how to make them realize that you're in the same boat with other poor people. Donald Trump doesn't give a fuck about you since we're
divide and conquer.
Right. So,
but just to clarify, I was talking about among racists. Like the fashion, I mean, I think that's what I was thinking about at least. So, although I think maybe for anyway, does that make sense? Like, I was talking about white racists,
yes,
before.
Okay,
so I think we agree.
So, this is an interesting
question. Feel free to push back, we can have a debate.
This is what I find fascinating about the rise of fascism happening right now, and everyone's like, well, it happened before. You know, Paul Krugman's having panic attacks in the New York Times editorial, you know, and it's like, the pitting of communities against each other is the fuel of the coalition of capitalists and the white supremacists. And we've seen this before historically, time and time again. So if we do want to go back and see what happened before, then we have to see what these patterns were in which that capitalist coalition of the Mitt Romney world that is suddenly okay with Donald Trump because of the tax cuts and the David Dukes can align, yet we're pitting Muslims against, you know, the Black community against Latino. I mean, just go around New York City and get everybody's opinion on the other group that's suddenly like...
Mexicans, like everybody.
Oh, my God. Like, everybody's just eating each other alive. And I worry, because I'm on a million different email threads from major organizations, that the amount of fear that we are using to drive up donations and maybe some protests are actually not helping us in the long run. The short game might help the institutions, but it's not helping the movement. And I'm not talking about the activist movement. I'm talking about, like, how do we win versus how do we... Brett Kavanaugh is a perfect example. I mean, that week was exhausting for so many of us and emotionally
exhausting.
It ruined
him. It destroyed him all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yes. And I think, I mean... That's it. But, you know, we were talking about Long Island. Long Island is the epicenter right now of Trump land, right? He's doing all these rallies in Long Island. And there have been a couple of really big wins for Democrats there. And a woman named Luba Gretchen Shirley ran against Representative King yesterday. And the Republicans poured in a shit ton of money into that district because Luba was amping up. You know, frankly, it was an identity argument. I like her a lot. She's a progressive. But, like, they were using a lot of identity. And that amped up the Republican base and the donations. And then they... have way more money, and then as a result, down ticket lost.
Mm. So I mean, I think that something that's not that much of a mystery is that economic policies appeal to everyone and the working class, right? There's this, like, going back to that false dichotomy, it's as if economic justice is inherently limited to white people or something.
Yeah, and the Democratic Party has struggled to, I think, their struggle for identity, I think, comes from the fact that they are corporatists. Right. And so what
they
do you do? Right. So what do you do if that is your, you know, fundamental ideology? So there are kind of similar circumstances like this in, I want to say, 1968, when Lyndon Johnson, he wasn't running again and Robert Kennedy was assassinated. So then that led the way for Richard Nixon to be elected. When the Democratic candidate lost, the Democratic Party had kind of an identity crisis, and they realized that they could no longer capture, you know, the rural white votes. Like, oh, they're just going all the way Nixon,
right?
Like all the way Law and Order, all the way racist. So let's take a step back and focus on identity. But by looking at kind of Black voters and LGBT issues and kind of environment conservative, like conservationalists, and not dealing with economic issues, they
Which
lost
all those other things too.
Exactly, they lost an opportunity to really be intersectional and say, okay, we can include these people some of them might actually want some progressive issues, even if they don't, like, the idea of progress scares them. They might still advocate for some of these issues. And by turning, you know, by making that false dichotomy, we've been in this continuous cycle where they're going back and forth between identities and not being intersectional.
Well, you also had something else that happened in the 70s that doesn't get talked about enough, and that was the Buckley versus Valeo decision, which opened...
Can
which,
you law nerds explain that?
Basically, the Supreme Court ruled that spending money is a protected form of speech under the First Amendment and is subject to strict scrutiny. So essentially... And it struck down spending limits for independent expenditures. So you can spend on political ads that you make for yourself or whatever. You could spend as much money as you want, and you could air them as many times as you want. And that paved the way for future decisions like Citizens United, which held that corporations have those same rights. So then corporations could start airing ads, and that's kind of where we're at today, just a mess of without getting into the every decision that led us there. I have that right?
I don't know.
Yeah, independent expenditure.
I read it a long time ago.
So the independent expenditures are not part of the campaign, just to make it very clear. Yeah. So campaigns still have campaign limits, but independent expenditures do not, because they have... They're a form of free speech, and they're a corporation. Their structure is a corporation. So now C4s and
that's the really dangerous one.
527s.
The fact that these nonprofit organizations that don't have to disclose their donors can just run unlimited ads. But this decision, I think, facilitated a shift in the Democratic Party to embrace big money in a way that it hadn't. Before, I mean, this is the Democratic Party of FDR, of the New Deal, of labor, the Democratic Party that Truman stood against the Taft-Hartley Act. I mean, this is
the war on poverty.
Yeah, right. And that went to the wayside.
Yeah, and all this coincides with, meanwhile, an attack on organized labor.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. And so, which then requires like money to come in from elsewhere. So it comes in from corporations. So let me ask everybody. I mean, do we think that real mobilization of people is possible at insofar as organized labor remains so weak? I mean,
and so tied to the Dems also.
Strong opinion.
Sorry,
on this.
Let me not divert your question.
They are very tied to. It's true that the leaders of the labor movement are very tied to the Dems, and then
which compromises them.
Yes,
and the compromises of the labor movement. Sorry, your question was more generally about how can we, with the weak labor movement, what are the options?
Yeah, and I mean, right? Doing your piece in Wisconsin, where there is like a rich labor history, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm sure I do. I'll let Nomi speak first.
When I went to Wisconsin, that's what I covered in January, was the fall, the collapse of labor. I mean, that was the test case for Republicans, you know, killing the labor movement in Wisconsin, where it was born. I mean, the labor movement
I mean, it's later, but NAFTA. Well, just throwing it back to the
NAFTA. But I mean, but I'm saying, like, they wanted to rip apart Wisconsin organized labor, which is the strongest in the country. Yeah. And they did. And then they decided to take it to Capitol Hill. And so Randy Brice defeating the speaker, you know, making him step down. Randy Brice didn't win, but he basically killed a guy who, like, lived off of Ayn Rand politics. Right. Was very symbolic and strong. But at the same time, I mean, in terms of organized labor, what does that mean? Organized labor is 85% weaker than it was 15 years ago. The largest donor of the Democratic Party in terms of labor is the teachers union, and charter schools have taken over our Democratic Party. And where you see splits between these centrist candidates like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, you know, really the buck stops at charter school money. That's where but one more fact that I think is really, really, really important for us to keep in mind in terms of movement. You look around the country, the same time the Democratic Party became centralized, they took money away from state parties, it was the same time the Koch brothers started infusing money into state parties for the Republicans.
Right.
And they started attacking unions at the state level. So not only do we have a weak Democratic Party, we don't have the infrastructure to train people. So there's a reason why we're falling for the same mistakes that we fell for decades ago. Because we don't have people out there, union leaders out there, organizing and recruiting strong organizers, because they just don't exist anymore. So candidates literally don't know who to go to. And they're making really bad mistakes.
Yeah. You know, and going back to white supremacy that we were talking about before, I was speaking recently to the historian Gerald Horn of the University of Houston. Brilliant guy. He was saying, I don't have the data to explain this, but he was saying that there is a correlation over history, especially in the 20th century. There's a correlation in his mind between the appeal of white supremacy and nativism and xenophobia and the attack on organized labor.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, I mean, it makes sense. And also because I think organized labor, though it's had its racist history and obviously periods, but it's one of the main ways to combat or mitigate racism. I mean, I think people learn about their common interests when they're in a union together, which is not to dismiss the racism that still happens among organized labor, but it's one way to mitigate it. And like you were saying, if you can't talk about class because you're a corporate party, then what else do people have to turn to, right?
Yeah.
White, I should say the white people who are racist. Like if you don't, if you need to compete with the racist narrative. And one of the ways you do that is with a class-based narrative. I think we're running out of time. Does anyone have guys want to make, I don't know, final word?
Midterms.
Midterms. What about them?
Just the word.
I wanted to reintroduce the word midterms.
Midterms, yes.
Went into 20th century history.
Midterms. Really quickly, you said, Nomi, that you think that there's too much of a focus on the presidential candidates and the elections. Of course, but we also can't reinvent the wheel.
Just candidates.
And there is like a leadership role. And I'm a cliche, but I think St. Bernard did create some, is somewhat responsible for some of the progressive. Not me, us. So not just him, but I think that he did help popularize a moral of clarity, a moral vision. So, and I think that in a turn has to be reinvested in terms of infrastructure and energy to the rest of the party, right? So it's not just one person, but people respond to stories, and I think they respond to characters and figures. And that's, it's like you need to have the infrastructure, but that per se won't defeat Trump. It's not like the Dems are going to be like, I'm excited about this town hall. Exactly. So who do we think, who do we want for 2020? We'll leave it on that.
And wait, who do we want for speaker as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That thing too.
Yeah.
Less important.
I haven't thought that far ahead. Honestly, I'm just not here for Democrats. Generally Elizabeth speaking.
Warren? So. No, I think she lost
she
that.
She hired?
I'm kidding. That ship, yeah, sailed.
I think this will speak for itself. The candidate who's been able to build a movement across all 50 states, that's what's going to defeat Trump. Trump has a movement. Trump has an infrastructure in 50 states with the Republican Party and their infrastructure and his weird movement agenda. You know, that partnership was brilliant for Donald Trump. Didn't win him the midterms, but it's going to win him the presidency again. So whoever is going to be able to compete with Donald Trump needs to have a partnership of ideas, infrastructure, and a movement.
And appeal.
And maybe charisma. And I think there's only one person.
Katie Halper
is our next president.
Or are you old enough? Bernie Sanders, right? Is that what you're saying?
Bernie, yeah, I guess that guy too.
Is that? Oh, I just want to make sure I wasn't missing it. It'd be funny if you were like Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Yeah,
the only hope Clinton. That yeah, Democrats yeah. have is Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Donna Shalala.
Well, she thank needs you. To run. Thank you guys so much. We have to wrap up, right? We could be here.
Wait, Barbara Lee for speaker.
I was going to ask.
I'd be about that.
How about Barbara Lee and Bernie as running together? You see them appearing together? It's amazing.
Oh, they've been doing that?
Yeah, they did an event together. Yeah.
No, of course Barbara Lee for speaker. I mean, you know, of course. It would be incredible.
BLS.
I mean, do we have a second choice? She's obviously
Anti-war.
In case of emergency, break glass and.
Another fascist emergency.
It's got to be her. Like Pelosi, you come in and you spent 2 years ensuring that this election was going to be a referendum on Trump, and then the first thing you say is we're going to strive for bipartisanship.
Oh my gosh! What? Yeah, you're right. She said that today. What? She also said, I think she said, "Let's hear it for pre-existing conditions," which obviously she didn't mean it that way, but I thought that was like the best line.
Can we stop saying blue wave now?
Who are these people?
What should we call it?
I'm just done with that. Like, if I see one more little blue wave on Twitter, I'm going to lose my mind.
Well, at the state level, there was a wave at the state level.
Well, I mean, here in New York, but not in every state. But
across the country, it picked up 7 governorships, and they cracked the GOP hegemony at the state level. It's now, in 2020, they're facing a much less of a climb to have a real say in the redistricting process, which will begin the next
nowhere,
year.
I hate to, this is where I'm going to be the downer, nowhere near where it should be.
No, given our, absolutely given our numbers. Not.
So I, the wave thing kills me because there are people in states who really need Democratic leadership and don't have it and probably deserve to given their population. And I just, I don't know who these messaging geniuses are in the Democratic Party is setting expectations unreasonably high and then like, you know.
It's more of a like a an ebb and flow instead of a wave.
It should have been though. They should have performed better than they did. I think objectively, in certain races.
They should get a new DNC chair.
And a new
another good thing. Keith leader. Ellison won. That's good.
Oh my gosh! Yes,
he won Attorney Payback. General of Minnesota. I'd rather have him in Congress. But what are you gonna do?
And he could have been Speaker.
Yeah, Barbara or Keith.
Oh, that would have been great payback.
Yeah. Yeah, for Tom Perez, and we'll talk about that next time. But what about you guys? Any final thoughts on 2020? Besides the Katie and Nomi.
I mean, I didn't mind that at all. Let's just do that. For 2020, I think we need to be thinking about grassroots organizing more. I think regardless of who we're going to be electing, as I mentioned earlier, politics is not a panacea. So no matter who we get in office, a lot of times these elected officials are going to be a figurehead, at least on the national level. So when it comes down to local organizing, I think that's going to be key. I think it's also going to be key in terms of, you know, not just building a movement for, you know, more people who lean left, but also a movement for radical transformation in this country. Without that, I don't think we're going to be able to see the systemic changes that we really need.
I'm kind of a single issue pundit, which is that I hate Russiagate.
Right.
I think Russiagate's been a disaster for the left. I really hope we drop it. It's led to, you know, venerating intelligence officials who don't deserve
the
our
FBI
veneration, like Jim Comey. It's led to focusing on a conspiracy theory and banking on that to solve all our problems. And I think the sooner we get rid of it, the sooner we can get that we can have the energy and the space, the focus to work on the important things.
And it's also led to a total hysteria among the media and like the smearing.
Don't
of
attack
people,
my soap.
Like you. Like, Aaron, you get this a lot. People are so vicious.
Are you a bot?
Yeah, you're a Russian bot, Putinist, right? But, I mean, that's, I think, one of the scariest things we've seen is people just pick up lines with no evidence and run with them. That, to me, is really scary. What was that?
They said that they bought more Russia. I mean, this is what the media is claiming. I heard it on CBS. That there was another wave of, like, Russia trying to infiltrate elections through social media, but not as high as 2000. So they, like, shut down all these accounts.
Yeah. All right, now I feel safer, and now Donald Trump is going to lose, obviously.
And Jeff Sessions is gone, so...
Right, exactly, my faves.
Well, I saw an article in Vox that was like, prepare for Benghazi times 10 or something like that. Like, we're going to scandalize Trump.
Oh,
like, there's going to be investigation after investigation
and we
if
didn't
you
even
don't
talk
like...
about how much that actually helps his popularity because Dems cannot comprehend that people have a different world view from them.
Right.
And when people see people... Exactly, when people see other people talking about Donald Trump like he's an unprecedented evil... They just identify more with him. He's just more of an outsider. More of a rule breaker. He's more of a bad boy.
And like, do we need more proof that he's a shady, awful person? Like, we know that, but the fact that that's true hasn't really translated into any big political victory.
I think the biggest way you defeat him is, besides having good opposition and good things that you're running for, is also you highlight the economic stuff. You say he's not keeping jobs here. You undo all of his xenophobic America First saving jobs narrative.
As my father always says, you can win the point and lose the argument. And yeah, I mean, Trump is and to quote another friend of mine, he says, Trump is made of mud, and the more mud you throw it in, the bigger he gets.
That's really good.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, I'm gonna say goodbye to you guys and then ask you to tell us where people can find you. So, Aaron, thank you so much. I don't know why I have to make a dramatic goodbye. Till next time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Where can people find you and your work?
I'm on Twitter, Aaron J. Matte, and I'm at The Real News, therealnews.com, and I write for The Nation magazine, The Nation. And I think that's it. Yeah.
Cool.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Miss Jabali, MissJabli. I always have to spell my name out because I've got one of those names. And my writing is in Glamour, Essence, Cosmopolitan, all over the place, current affairs. So,
and read her article, The Color of Economic Anxiety.
Hi, I'm Nomi Konst. I'm running for public advocate of New York City. You can find more about me everywhere if you're in New York. Please donate to my campaign. We have matching funds in the city. No, but seriously, we do have matching funds in the city. So every donation up to $175 is 6 times that until the end of the year. And then it's 8 times afterwards because we just passed a charter revision. NomiKeyKonst.com, NomiKeyKonst.com. Same thing on Twitter, same thing on Instagram. Thank you for letting me solicit.
Of course, yeah.
I may have broken a law or two.
I'm Katie Halper, KT Helps, letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S, on Twitter and on Instagram. And you can check my show, The Katie Halper Show, on SoundCloud and iTunes and all that.
And I'm Walker Bragman. You can find me on Twitter and at Walker Bragman. Super creative. And you can read my stuff at Paste. And come back next time.
Woohoo! Yeah.
Thank you guys for coming, and we hope that you'll join us again.
Yeah. Same time, same place.
Best philosophy class ever.
Yeah, it's good, right?
We'll be more punctual.
Yeah. Yes.
Although we're the left, that's how we roll. No. Alrighty. Bye, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, Pace Politics. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.